Hey, spooky people, Megan here. Before we get to today's episode, I want to ask you for a favor. Like many podcasts, we are an independent production and are working hard to grow our audience. If you're enjoying the show, you can help us by taking a few seconds of your time to hit that subscribe or follow button and by leaving us a rating. As always, thanks for listening. And now on to the episode.
If you Google online, you know, that same kind of phenomena, right? People say, like, in a dark room, I had hallucinations. Turns out that's a really common thing for children to have.
Yeah.
But I never knew that. And I bet a lot of people who claim to have had weird experiences with ghosts or whatever also don't know how common those sorts of mild, you know, non-deleterious hallucinations are.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, I really just think that our brains are weirder than we think they are, and we never talk about it.
I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
I'm Anne-Marie Kelly. Wild Precious Life is a podcast about dreaming big, digging in and connecting across distance, division, and loss. In each episode, I talk with prize-winning writers, musicians, and wanderers who remind all of us how we can make the most of the time we have. So meet me here. Let's walk and talk and dream and discover what it means to be wild, precious, and brave.
Hello, you are listening to episode 20 of Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual.
This week, we are joined by a special guest, Dr. Chris Cogswell. Chris has a PhD in chemical engineering. He is the chair of SkyHub Science Advisory Board, which will be our main topic today, and he is the host of the Mad Scientist podcast. Chris, would you like to say hi and tell our listeners a little bit about your interests and background?
Yeah. Hello, listeners. So, So like you said, I am the host of the Mad Scientist podcast. My show focuses on we're kind of like sister shows in a way. So we have, you know,
we are.
It's so exciting. Like, we wanted to look at these topics from the scientific angle. And for me, that interest really started through my philosophy kind of degree and then independent research I did while I was an undergraduate at the University of New Hampshire, and kind of continued when I was a grad student, really bored on Wikipedia, looking up, you know, UFO encounters or whatever in the XRD room at Northeastern University. So our show tries to look at these things in a comedic light. We try not to take ourselves or the topics too seriously, but we also try to make sure that we're always aware and always respectful of the fact that, you know, these are real people. And in some ways, if they're, whether or not they're reporting things that really happened to them, they're still, you know, worth listening to, because in some ways it might be more interesting if every UFO report was just, you know, people misunderstanding what they see around them. Like, that's almost a weirder thing, right? It's crazy. So that's kind of the show. So we release weekly. We've been going for a long time now. We're on our fifth season. And if you haven't listened to us yet, please check us out.
Yeah. Awesome. and I've listened to a bunch of episodes, and we tend to find like a similar theme when we're doing our show, that a lot of times, like, there have been several topics where we'll go into it thinking like, oh, this is like really spooky and the stories that people tell are really spooky, and then it's like the real life explanation behind like why they might be telling that story is significantly more terrifying. Like the Boogeyman episode, I was like, oh, very uncomfortable afterwards.
Yeah, that one messed me up.
And we like just talked about like sleep paralysis a week ago, and I was like, no.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel like I remember the first time that ever happened to me, and maybe this is just myself like mythologizing my childhood now that I look back at it, but
sure.
I had a book. I still have the book, actually. It's literally the pages are falling out of the binding, but it was called Mysteries of the Unexplained. I'm looking at a copy of it right now, and it was published by like Reader's Digest. And my mom used to just like come home with books for me. you know, which was awesome. And really, yeah. I'm so thankful that I had that kind of upbringing with her. And a lot of the times the books would be on, you know, like weird subjects or whatever, because I'm sure she was getting them as a single mom. I'm sure she was getting them at, like, you know, the dollar bin at Barnes and Noble or whatever. And so this book, in it, the scariest section to me always when I was a kid was the section on, like, demonic possession. Like, I thought those so freaking scary. And I'll never forget the first time I, like, you know, so, you know, read this book and scared the crap out of myself as a kid. And then and then we got a computer with the internet, or we got the internet, I guess, and got on there. And the first thing I did was go on to, like, paranormal forums and whatever. And then reading about, you know, how many of those exorcism cases were just, like, people that were sick. You know what I mean? Or women that were like, you know, I have an idea. And then their church leader was like, she's a witch. You know, like, those were. So I remember that, like, the first case was, it's not even really that famous of a case, but it was just this, this girl who was said to be possessed in, like, Brazil or something. And then they found out that she was, like, you know, she was like you're saying, just having, like, sleep paralysis episodes, essentially.
Yeah.
Which, again, maybe that's scarier because, like, that can happen to anybody. You know, yeah, like, right. You don't even have to make a deal with a demon to be sleep paralyzed. It can just happen to you.
Yes. Yeah, that's what we've learned. So we talked about it with respect to people mistaking sleep paralysis episodes for, like, thinking that they've been abducted in the middle of the night. So we're, like, on theme for a couple weeks in a row here. I definitely went through a period when I was younger, when I was, like, in grade school, where I was, like, checking out a bunch of books on alien encounters and stuff from the library. And I got one, and it was, like, obviously not written for children, because I, like, got to one of the chapters, and this was when I was, like, 9 years old, and one of the chapters was about, like, someone having some sort of, like, sexual encounter with, like, an alien who came down, like, into the bedroom. No. And I was like, Mom, I don't think I should have this book. So she was like, yeah, we'll take that back to the library.
Oh my God.
So my poor little brain. We're super excited to have you on today. I think maybe you got in touch with us, or vice versa, like, pretty early on when we were starting the podcast, because, like you said, it's exciting to see somebody who does something quite similar. And yeah, one thing that I wanted to mention about your podcast is I was just listening to the episode where you interviewed Brian Regal.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking to him next month, March. I don't know. It's, like, in the future. Things are scheduled so far now. but I really liked the part where you guys talked about how you had, like, bets going with people about certain paranormal things. Like, you said that you had some, like, bet out there that you'll pay, you know, a psychic, or, like, you'll promote a psychic as, like, actually being psychic if they can figure out the code word that you and your wife have for if one of you, like, becomes a ghost.
Yeah.
To let the other one know. Which I think is awesome. And Paige, I think we're gonna have to, like, think of code words for each other. So we can let each other know.
Definitely. You know, it's funny with that. The first person I ever heard of doing that was Houdini. Who is, like, you know, obviously, I think for a lot of us interested in this stuff, Houdini is, like, you know, the great debunker, right? Like, he was awesome in, and yeah, him and his wife had a code word because they were so into seances and stuff. Mm-hmm. My wife and I have a code word. We've also had cases, and yeah, so far no one has even come close to guessing it. in any way, shape, or form. We also, it's actually funny, I used to be on a radio show called Spaced Out Radio with a friend of mine, Dave Scott, and on that show, like, I was, you know, it was kind of weird. It was, so we would do these science sections where Dave is, like, super, he really believes in a lot of this stuff, believes himself to be an experiencer. Then it was me, who I was supposed to be kind of, like, the good skeptic, or, like, the happy skeptic. And then we had this other guy, Chris George Zuger, who was, like, you know, the devil skeptic. Like, he was so mean and just all, you know. But what's funny is that Chris Zuger has had, like, he believes he's an not an abductee, but he believes he's an experiencer of UFO events. So it's like, you know, I was like the good cop, but I don't know, my bad cop was, you know, a week from retirement, ready to blow. But but even on that show, we had one of the questions 1 week was, you know, we just had a psychic on who's really good at remote viewing. What do you say to that? And on, you know, I was like, I'll give her $500 if she can remote view the drawing I'm making right now. Doesn't have to be right now. I'll just have the drawing and, you know, she has to try and guess it. Still not guessed. It's weird. They never try to prove themselves. It's so weird. It's so weird that way.
Well, there's an explanation for that.
Yeah, maybe there is. It, you know, my wife actually, she doesn't have it anymore because we sold the car she had that had this in there. But we live and when I was in grad school, we lived in Medford, Mass, and we're currently still in Massachusetts, but we're like only 30 minutes, you know, really like maybe 40 minutes now where we are from Salem.
Oh, and nice.
Salem's great because it's this awesome city with so much history and everything else. And of course, there's all this, you know, horror movie kind of stuff there all the time. And we went one summer with my mom just to kind of visit for the day, get lunch, whatever. And my mom loves psychics and like tarot cards and all that kind of stuff. She's always loved it. And so her and my wife went in. This was when we were still engaged. They both went into a psychic where my mom was like, we'll pretend, Katie, I'm going to be like your mother and you be my daughter and we'll see what the psychic says. And the psychic told my wife that she would meet a handsome gentleman at work finally and that all of her marital problems would be over. So I'm still waiting for that. We'll see what happens.
That's pretty hilarious. That's awesome. Yeah, we were supposed to do a trip to Salem this past fall, but obviously that got postponed. So fingers crossed for fall 2021.
Yeah, seriously. Oh my goodness. If you go to Salem, let me know. I have to take you guys out for beer and burger someplace.
That would be so great.
Yeah, it's so cool. Oh my god, I love Salem. Exciting.
Okay, so yes, we could just like chit chat about random stuff forever, but we'll actually talk about what we're supposed to talk about today. Okay, so Paige, do you want to go first? Did anything spooky happen to you this week?
Nope, nothing. It comes in waves. Right now, nothing's going on. It's been pretty quiet around here, so I have nothing to report. All of you. What about you, Megan?
I think I typed in our notes literally nothing. So this podcast has probably made us more skeptical, so now we're like, just nothing is spooky anymore. But generally I've just been enjoying the political events that have happened in the past week and truly enjoying watching how genuinely happy Dr. Fauci seems to be.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's pretty wonderful.
He's like a kid with a new bike. He's so happy.
I know. It's so cute. Okay, anyway.
All righty.
So, Chris, did anything spooky happen to you recently that you would want to share?
Spooky stuff, just I don't know, my aura is wrong or my chakras are all messed up. My spooky stuff just never happens to me. Well, I guess I've had like a couple of spooky things, but as I get older they happen less and less frequently, so nothing really spooky, I guess. hanging out, enjoying life.
Hey, that's great. Yeah. Spooky stuff is always happening to me, so let me tell you, it's not as exciting as it may sound.
it's fine. Okay, so now we can talk about SkyHub. Yay! So like Paige mentioned, Chris is the chair of a program called SkyHub, of their Science Advisory Board. So, Chris, can you give us like the elevator pitch for what what is SkyHub?
SkyHub is a citizen science effort made to analyze objects, birds, planes, whatever, in the skies above us. So we utilize a Jetson Nano as the main computer piece to this unit. That then connects over to a camera. Currently, we're using a fisheye camera. And then we have actually built freely available software, which will take the video from that camera, turn on recording when a object comes into frame. And then we're currently building the capabilities of analyzing those objects for different applications. The most interesting application, I think, for most people listening to this show probably is going to be identifying objects in the skies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we're hoping to do essentially is, if you have a unit like this out there on your home or, you know, on your patio or whatever, it can, it'll constantly be viewing the sky. It will begin recording and then analyzing when an object comes into frame. And then if that object conforms to sort of a standard set of data that we've taught it about things like, say, a bird or an airplane or an insect or whatever, that video will then get siloed and categorized as one of those objects. The goal being that if we see things that don't look like normal things, right? So if it's like a drone or if it's a UFO or if it's whatever, we'll be left with a much better set of data from which to start those sorts of investigations.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're excited about this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super cool. So you said, yeah, identifying objects, and obviously, you know, a lot of what I've seen and sort of the aspect that we're also interested in is, like, potentially you guys could catch, like, UFOs on there.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's interesting. So an idea like this has sort of existed in the UFO community for a while. There's mm-hmm. kind of been thoughts about doing something like this. The problem with that, or the issue, I guess, with those efforts, not that there's really, you know, there are units that kind of can do some of that before mm-hmm. that are out there, but they're mostly video capture units. They don't actually analyze anything.
Okay.
Because, frankly, the programming prowess wasn't there, both in the people trying to do this stuff in, like, the late 2000s, early 2010s, but also just literally, you know, these are engineers trying to put this stuff together, not necessarily software programmers who are expert in machine learning and things like that. So mm-hmm. our team is really fortunate in that we have on it people who are really well-versed in these areas of programming, of machine object detection, of machine learning. So we're really fortunate to have those folks on board who are able to help us with this. So, mm-hmm. And the goal ultimately is, you know, in my mind, this is what my role, or one of my roles as the chair of the Science Advisory Board is not just to, cause you know, the thing with the UFO community is that they're kind of going to be on board regardless of what you do. You know, like, it's really hard to lose the UFO community. If you're just out there being like, I'm going to look for UFOs, they're like, I'm with you. Yes. You know, it's really hard to lose them.
Yeah.
It's the scientific community that we really have to kind of work with and try to get interested in stuff like this, because
right.
the history of the UFO subject in science is not very good, because the scientists that have get involved or have gotten involved have either been chased out or mm-hmm. The scientists who stick around tend not always to be the most scrupulous, I guess, is the kindest way to say that.
Sure.
So one of the big challenges is, or not really a challenge, but one of the big opportunities, I think, for us is the use of this sort of system for other things besides just looking for UFOs. Like, that's going to be the cool thing that the public is interested in. But there's going to be a section of people who we hope will want to use these things for, like, satellite tracking or tracking of drones above their facilities or bird watching or just tracking the night sky. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with a camera that has kind of pre-built within it a machine learning capability that allows it to detect objects and then categorize them. So that's really what our big, I guess, you know, in my wildest dreams of how this project could be successful or not. You know, I would love, of course, if we capture something weird on these cameras and, you know, we can go and show it off and be like, look, this is crazy. What is this? But I'd also be really thrilled if, you know, an amateur astronomy group purchased one of these and, or built one, I should say, not really purchased, but built one using our help and, you know, used it for stargazing, or someone doing a study of like bird migrations, set up some units, right? Like that'd be so cool. And there's so much potential there for it.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I want to set one up.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Yeah, this interview has been wildly successful, right?
Yeah. we're gonna talk about that at the end. I have some questions about about setting up the rigs, because I definitely, well, Paige, I'm sure you're not surprised. I presented this idea to my husband Steve, who's very into building computers and, you know, is always like itching to be able to build something new like that. And he was very excited about this idea.
Nice. There we go. Good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you get the nerds in, then it's like, all right, you're fine.
I was maybe having a similar conversation with Elliot prior to us getting under record. I mean, we don't have a place to like put anything right now, but in the future.
Yeah, you guys would have to wait till you have
My unit currently, it's funny, actually, I just purchased a Wi-Fi connector sort of thing to put on there so that I can put it outside finally. But currently the only thing that my, you know, other people's units are out there like on their homes getting actual cool video of stuff. And mine is in my office right now getting pictures of my cat occasionally. You know, so it's like, you know, thank God it's not on production mode yet. But it's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So correct me if I'm wrong. SkyHub is pretty new, right? Like the last couple of years.
SkyHub was within the last couple of months.
Months. Okay.
Yeah. So we've, it's really new. So the project initially started. So again, like I've said, there have been other attempts to do stuff like this before. And so the SkyHub team actually kind of came together originally on another similar project that wasn't going to be open source, and then that you know, there was some disagreement internally and whatever, and so then this team broke apart, and the folks who came together founded SkyHub to kind of continue the stuff they were thinking about in that other group.
Gotcha.
So, and that happened maybe about a year and a half ago at the most, maybe a little bit longer than that, maybe 2 years ago, but I came on board this last summer officially.
Okay,
gotcha.
Yeah, and I guess what was your, like, other than, because you've been in, like, some similar positions, but, like, how did you meet up with these people or get connected with them?
Yeah, so I got connected with them actually through, so my involvement in the UFO community has kind of started out from the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And from the beginning, I've always felt from the time when I was a kid that if there's any relevancy or reality to any of these kind of scary stories, you know, we scare ourselves with, that the UFO story to me was always the most compelling one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew people who had experiences. Mm-hmm. And also because it's not that far of a stretch outside of what we think of as, say, normal science today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you ask the vast majority of scientists if they think there's a possibility that intelligent life exists out there in the universe besides us, the vast majority of them will say yes. That is wildly different than it was, say, 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as our ability to kind of scan the skies and understand them and even travel the skies, as our ability to do that gets better and better, I suspect that we're going to eventually come to an answer to that question. And I think it's going to be quite, again, regardless of if it's true or not, I think it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
And so for me, I got involved in this stuff because I was doing the podcast. I was sort of thinking and writing about the UFO community and, you know, scientific science communication and engaging sort of non-traditional communities in science. And by non-traditional communities, I mean, like, literally, I mean, like, people who believe in conspiracy theories. You know what I mean? People who believe they've been abducted by UFOs. Right. Not that they're in the same, not that they're, those two are even in the same category, but, you know, that's often what the public thinks of.
Yeah.
And it's kind of unfair, right? Because a lot of the people who claim to have, you know, if you ever speak to somebody who really feels like they've had an abduction experience, it's really easy to tell the difference between someone who genuinely, I think, has been affected by an experience and someone who's just looking for attention or whatever.
Sure.
And not just because the people who have had a real experience are often like crying to you, you know, like it's really terrifying. Yeah. They're legitimately terrified. It's a real thing to them. Mm-hmm. So I was doing this show and someone I'm friends with basically was like, you know, why don't you actually put your money where your mouth is? Like, if you want to try to talk and engage with these communities, just go talk and engage with these communities.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, oh, that's weird. I guess now I've been called out. I guess I have to. I reached out to some local UFO groups and people did radio shows and whatever, and was really welcomed into their community pretty warmly. And then I started saying that I didn't believe some cases, and my warm welcome quickly soured.
Oh no!
but that's okay. You know, you have to expect that. You know, but yeah. It has led to some really cool things, including being able to engage with, you know, engage with the people at SkyHub, and also engage with, again, people who hold beliefs that maybe I don't hold, but who I think genuinely believe them and who I think are, again, worth hearing and listening to. Because, you know, that's the other part of this. And I could answer this question for like the rest of the night. So just stop me when you need me to stop answering this question.
You're fine.
There's always been a disconnect between sort of academia and the public. Mm-hmm. And we often think about that disconnect or that disparity in terms of like, you know, it's educational, it's economic, it's social, it's all these other things. But since the like 60s, it's also been a change in like legitimate worldview and facts about the world.
Mm.
And we just thought, I think most people in power, politicians and academics and whoever, people with kind of economic control on the population, believed for a long time that those conspiracy beliefs, those non-traditional beliefs, those that distrust of science and expertise, I think for a long time they thought that that was just sort of a fringe community that didn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't true. It's never been true. Mm-hmm. It's always the mob with pitchforks that but really though, right? It's always the public with their superstitions and their, you know, non-bourgeois thinking, right? That change really the way that the world happens.
Yeah.
And we've kind of like learned that lesson in American history and then unlearned it over and over again. And I think this is a period in time where we're kind of relearning it again and being like, well, maybe we shouldn't have just been saying all these UFO people are crazy. Maybe we should have been listening to them. Or like, you know, maybe we should have been engaging with crazy Uncle Ted who thinks that the lizard people control the NWO. And, right? Because now Uncle Ted is a senator. You know what I mean? Like, it
matters. Oh, God.
So it's really kind of to me, it's more important than just kind of being interested in UFOs and getting involved in it. Like, it's literally about, you can talk to people on common ground. You have to meet people where they live. You have to meet people where they actually are on subjects. And a large portion of the public, they're only – like a good example of this is Ancient Aliens. I hate that show with a passion. But Ancient Aliens is like the only interaction most people have with archaeology in their entire lives.
Yeah.
That's like true. What archaeology is. You know, and it's the same thing with science. Most people who ever interact with science, like in the public, they're thinking scientists are like Neil deGrasse Tyson calling people stupid. That's not true.
Yeah.
And it creates a, of course it breeds distrust because, you know, the stuff people are hearing about science or the scientists people know of aren't trustworthy and aren't really listening to them and are creating yeah. straw men about them and mm-hmm. all these other things. So it's, you know, if you have to pick between, you know, some fancy guy with a title who's, you know, yelling about whatever on TV or, you know, your local pastor who is there with you every day and, you know, she gives you good advice. Who are you going to listen to? The yeah. person in your community.
Yeah. Well,
anyways, they asked me via email to get involved okay. with SkyHub.
That's the short version.
Yeah, it's the answer.
So we have to ask, though, have you personally seen a UFO? Or do we – I feel like now it's like it's you're not supposed to call them UFOs. You're supposed to call them UAPs, but I don't know.
Oh, my God. The UFO UAP thing. It's so – I have – seen things in the sky that I can't explain, but I have not, but I don't know if they're you. Like, I don't know if they're aliens and ships.
Yeah. Right.
Like I could, you know, I can't tell the difference between like a blue jay and a, you know, and a cardinal most yeah. days. Right. Like right. I don't know. what I would say is, so when I was a kid, I had, and I actually still have really vivid. So, okay. I have obsessive compulsive disorder and that has been kind of exacerbated by, you know, anxiety and whatever and all this other garbage. But mm-hmm. so, when I was a kid and even now today, I think a lot of the symptoms of my anxiety come through in really, really bad nightmares.
Okay. And
also just sort of like, you know, like I can recall dreams every morning. I'm, you know, like I dream every night. I have very vivid dreams and I recall them really easily. Usually. And when I was a kid, those dreams tended to be of the scary variety.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, so when I finally kind of got up the courage to, so one of the dreams I remember that was very scary was, I was in my parents' bedroom at night. I wasn't supposed to be in there. I was watching cable and eating like a tin of popcorn, like those holiday tins.
That's a great night right there.
It's a great night, right? So I was watching something I'm sure that was too scary that I wasn't supposed to be up at, you know, to watch. And I remember the next thing I remember is there being a glowing green light in the Ooh. In the bathroom hallway. So mm-hmm. The bed looked towards the wall, but on that same wall where the TV was, there was a entranceway to the hallway and the bathroom was like to the right of the hallway. So mm-hmm. I remember seeing in the doorway a green glowing light that kind of shone in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't remember anything else. I remember waking up. And when I told my mom about this, she was like, oh yeah, you were probably just having like another fever dream like you used to have.
Yeah.
Like you were just having a nightmare, you know? And I told her this when I was like 10 and I was like, Dora, I think I saw an alien. And she's like, you're a moron. You know, she didn't say it that way, but you know, like, but I often think to myself though, had my mom been someone who believed in UFOs, she might've been like, oh my God, you were abducted too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
Like it's
totally.
It's like not, it's not a far gap between me having a show where I talk about, you know, the science of this stuff versus me having a show where I'm talking about, you know, my experiences as the next, you know, alien messiah. So, you know, I often, so I guess what I'll say is any of the scary experiences I've had in my life, I tend to think were caused by, or at least exacerbated by anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think actually that's probably true of the vast majority of people who claim to have had experiences. Like one thing we talk about on the show a lot, and it's something that I try to bring up every time I talk to somebody who said they've had an experience, is we never as like a society talk about the way other people think, like literally mm-hmm. functionally how you cognate. You know? So like when you think of like the bouncing red ball, what is happening in your brain? Like what is happening in your mind? So like Paige, you go first. You're thinking of a bouncing red ball. What are you thinking?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just looking at the ball and thinking about how it's bouncing.
Okay. So that's one answer. Okay, Megan.
There's not much going on up there. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I guess I would picture like one of those like super ball bouncy ball kind of things, just bouncing up and down from the floor.
Okay.
Like you had when you were a kid.
Okay. Now you're both thinking and not. You're probably not hearing anything. Maybe you're hearing bouncing, right? Mm-hmm. But you're both describing like a mental image that you have. When I think of the bouncing red ball, my brain, like I say in my head, the bouncing red ball, I have a hard time visualizing what that would look like in my own mind's eye.
Okay. Yeah, like I can definitely like see an image of like in my mind of a bouncing
like I,
red
yeah,
ball.
Like I can make myself see an image if I really kind of like sit and think about it. But when I have thoughts in my head, even in the day, like, you know, oh, it's a nice day outside today, I'm like saying that to myself in my head because I am a dangerously insane individual. You know what I mean? Like but that's what I'm saying. We don't that is a very simple thought we just described. And the three of us had fairly different versions of that together.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Now think of something even more complicated, right? A scary event where you're on edge already in the middle of the night where you're probably just waking up from a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Of course people would have different ways of thinking. You know, it's not – it when you think of it that way, it's not that – crazy to think that there would be people who maybe have a common way of thinking together, but some people who have kind of an odd way of thinking about the world or cognating who have events like this happen that then they can't explain. Like it's, you know, to me, part of the problem is people assume like another example from when I was a kid. I grew up in New York City. So I never, like, when I went to bed at night, it was, like, still really, like, you could read by the light from the street lamps. You know what I mean? Like, in my bedroom. Like, it never got dark in my house, really. And so when I would go to my cousin's house in New Jersey, where they lived, like, on a hill, kind of in a wooded area, where it really did get, like, pitch black at night, that was freaking terrifying to me.
Yeah.
And when you're sitting in a dark room and you haven't been in a dark room really before, your eyes do all kinds of weird things.
Yeah.
You know, you get sunspots or kind of, you know, that fuzz you get when you rub your eyes or whatever. Right.
Right.
If you Google online, you know, that same kind of phenomena, right? People say like in a dark room, I had hallucinations. Turns out that's a really common thing for children to have.
Yeah.
But we've never, but like, I never knew that. And I bet a lot of people who claim to have had weird experiences with ghosts or whatever also don't know how common those sorts of mild, you know, non-deleterious hallucinations are.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah. So, you know, I really just think that our brains are weirder than we think they are and we never talk about it. So people see ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah, although to our credit, I think like frequently on this show we've talked about like, hey, your brain is really freaky and weird.
Well, you have to, right? Well, that's the thing.
Right.
If you're going to talk about this stuff, like you have to talk about it because it is, you know, just most people are like, if they're like, well, I think I saw a ghost, and you're like, well, maybe you imagined it.
Yeah.
Most people's first thing is going to be like, well, no, that's, I'm not crazy. Like I didn't like
right, yeah,
ghost. And
right.
It's like, you don't have to be crazy. Your brain just is. You know, everyone does that. Your brain is just normal then.
Yeah. Well, it's like when we were talking about the abduction stuff, it's like people actually, whether or not it actually happened to them, they believe that it's real. Like they have actual, in some cases, PTSD-like responses to hearing the stories about it. So, yeah. So it's pretty intense for people. But... Yeah. Your brain is really weird.
Yeah.
Well, it's a common theme. I think it's also a surprise of like doing this podcast was I think going into it, I didn't realize how much of it would be like just talking about weird psychological stuff that happens inside your mind to like make people think that, yeah, they're seeing ghosts or being abducted by aliens or demons or possessing them or whatever is happening. So yeah, it's weird.
I think that the beauty though about doing that, or I guess the important thing about doing that is when you do get to a case that really you have a really hard time explaining,
mm-hmm.
it's even more interesting then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about abductions on our show a lot and done those episodes and sort of, you know, poo-pooed a lot of them and, you know, not really poo-pooed because, again, like you're saying, these are people who had like world-changing, you know, nightmare-inducing experiences. It's not really funny for them. But then we had someone come on the show. His name is Kyle, and he came on the show and told us about his experience where, like, as a kid at night, he would relatively frequently wake up in like the woods behind his house. And okay. that, and the door would be locked and his parents would yell at him like he had escaped from his room.
Oh, man.
You know, and he was like, I was put here.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Like that is interesting.
Uh-huh.
Outside. And again, of course, there's always the chance, you know, that this guy's just lying to you, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe, but you know, but why? Why? You know, he didn't get, we didn't use his real name. He has never come out in public about this.
Yeah.
He only contacted the show because he went through like someone who is a counselor for people who have had experiences like this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's not like making money on a book deal or something.
Right.
He's just a normal guy who was like, this terrifying thing happens to me sometimes and I don't know why. And I don't know if it's real or not, but like, but what the hell?
You know? Yeah.
That's yeah. compelling to me.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. So I guess, well, since we're sort of on this already, and the, you know, whole UFO alien abduction thing, one thing that I did before we get back to some of the SkyHub questions, one thing I did want to do because I got very worked up about watching that documentary, The Phenomenon. I think that's when I reached out to you on Twitter to be like, what do you think about this? It's very but yeah, just to get like your opinion on some of the current stuff going on or like the current high profile UFO sightings. And I think you had said, because we had done an episode on UFOs before and we didn't talk about a lot of the older stuff. We focused more on the recent stuff that had been going on with them releasing the Navy videos and everything. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak for Paige, but I'm like pretty – like I have little to no doubt that there are everyday explanations for those. So I'm very interested to like hear your take, especially because there's more of that stuff sort of being released all the time and people pushing for it and yeah.
I would agree. I left that episode feeling pretty certain that there was some sort of everyday explanation to the Navy videos.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's – well, okay. It's hard. With the yeah. Navy videos, with the anytime you have – like the Navy videos is such – it's so far out of the realm of what we as everyday people experience. Like
right.
I have never flown an airplane.
Right.
You know, like I've never been in a, I don't even think I've been within, you know, 200 feet of a fighter jet.
Right.
You know, one time in Boy Scouts as a kid, I slept over on a Navy cruiser. You know, like it's so far out of the realm of everyday experience that it's sort of hard to just come out and be like, well, that was obviously, you know, a bird or whatever.
Right? Yeah.
I think that's probably too, that's a little too presumptuous, I guess.
Yeah.
Because,
well, yeah, and fair enough. Like, I do definitely agree that, like, that was definitely a sticking point that we had, where it was like, okay, sure, like, you can go in here and like, McWest has, you know, recreated videos that look very right. similar to the footage that was taken and done the trigonometry or whatever to calculate, you know, how far these things actually were and how they could be moving. Yeah. Right. But, yeah, I think I definitely did come back to the fact that, like, wouldn't these guys know what those things look like?
Right.
Like, why would they get worked up about it?
Yeah, the other thing to consider, too, is that how often really does the average, say, Navy personnel ever encounter something like a drone in the sky? Or or an enemy aircraft, even, you know?
Yeah.
Like, most people I know who were in the Navy or are in the Navy talk about it like, it, you know, mostly, like, most of the time talking to people who are in the Army, it's mostly doldrum. Like, you mostly just hang out and wait for stuff to happen or to be told to do stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, I think there's a couple different things going on here. I think on the one hand, it is sort of presumptuous of us to assume that we would know better than these people who have been trained to do this. On the other hand, this is a rare occurrence even for them. This is probably the first time they've ever seen something like this in the sky. You know, for all the people on that ship, frankly, you know, outside of maybe some who served, you know, we haven't had like a naval warfare encounter in forever, you know? So it's kind of like a, you know, to me, it's not that crazy to think that there would be, you know, they could be mistaken as well. I do think, though, at the same time that, you know, the math that Mick puts out there is compelling.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to kind of go away from that. But at the same time, though, I think, you know, the problem with math applied after the fact is the difference of 1 degree of angle for an object that far away changes, like, you know, hypersonic speed from, you know, bird speed. Right. Sure. Like, that's the problem with trigonometry when you're talking about, like, kilometers away from something. It's, you know, it's not like a huge change. So I think frankly, on a case like that, you just sort of have to say, like, well, we don't know, you know, like, we don't, because we can't know, we don't know. And I do think, though, that, you know, the problem with a lot of this is there's a lot of extraneous stuff to the Navy video and to kind of the rollout of those videos in the New York Times and everything else that do make me suspicious of other parts of it, I guess I'll say. You know, I mean, for example, like, it's no coincidence that. So have either of you seen the documentary Surviving Death yet?
No.
No.
That's relatively new, and it's on Netflix.
That's from the same reporter who wrote the New York Times article.
Oh,
because that's her beat. Her she's on the spooky beat. Like, she wrote a book about life after death, and she has worked with Robert Bigelow, like, her entire, you know, not her entire career, but a big portion of their career together.
Yeah.
And so now when Bigelow comes out after Surviving Death comes out on Netflix and is like, by the way, I'll give you $500,000 if you can prove ghosts are real. That's not a coincidence.
You know? Okay. Did he say that recently?
Yeah. Yeah, he said it like yesterday or the day before. It's like not. So it's the same thing with these sorts of, you know, the UFO community is interesting. People think that the conspiracy has been the military, right, has been hiding these secrets and whatever. In my mind, the conspiracy is that it's like the same 4 to 5 people making money off of this, or something. I can't even say making money, wasting money on this story for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, really, it has been. Every major story has been linked to these people. Bob Lazar, Skinwalker Ranch. You know, now the kind of consciousness stuff to the Stars Academy. Like, it's all like the same 7 people. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many times do you get to swing at the pinata and miss before someone takes the stick away? You know, like, really.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, and I think that, Well, here, we're going to skip around again. Sorry, Paige.
No, that's fine.
I think, too, though, that like bringing up Bigelow and like To the Stars Academy and all that stuff. And like, I think that sort of differentiates or Sky Hub is quite different from, or at least I see it as quite different from some of these other organizations, because they're, you know, funded by these like huge private enterprises and like people presumably with their own biases and stuff. We're like more of like a citizen science project, I guess. Like, yeah.
And I mean, to Chris's point earlier, like the point of Sky Hub isn't to prove or disprove UFOs, really.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, if they find them, great. But like, it's not like your whole goal is to go out there and show everyone that aliens are visiting.
Right. Like, it's also about the like the technology and the data processing behind it, which is
neat. Just like, you know, with any good scientific project, right? Like, you don't, or engineering project, frankly, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You don't spend, you know, 5 years in a lab working on one experiment that then could fail magically. You know, like, oh, I guess I'm not getting my PhD. Ha ha ha. Right? Like, you don't do that. Like, you have other applications in mind. You have other things that you can do and other ways to do this. One of the other big things with Sky Hub, and one of the reasons why I wanted to be involved in it, frankly, is because everything, we're trying to be as transparent as possible.
Right.
Like, the source code for the system is online right now. Mm-hmm. Like, you could go download the source code and play with it. All of the data as it gets collected is going to be made into a format where the public can download it and see it and use it as they would like to. Like, we're trying really hard to be as open with this stuff as we possibly can be, because otherwise, like you said, it's, you know, it might as well be one of those other projects that kind of, you know, hasn't been as open, let's say.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, not to put words in your mouth, because I have no idea like what your relationship is with any of those people. But like, the stuff that we've looked at, like, a lot of it seems quite problematic. there's a lot of it that seems problematic. And I think I definitely wanted to, just reiterate that it's so nice that Sky Hub is so open, because you can go, you know, you can go on there and you can read about Chris and you can read about the other founders, and you can like look at everything involved and look at how to put together the rig. And you guys have stuff up on there about, you know, data that's been collected thus far and everything. So I guess one other question I wanted to ask was, like, you were at MUFON for some time. So in like the, so MUFON's kind of a funny one for us, because I think we initially looked into it some, or Paige looked into it some, and they had a lot of stuff behind like a paywall, which was discouraging. And and you know, I also know why you left, obviously, which is like sort of a bad thing in the UFO community that freaks me out a little bit. But were your plans there, like, because you were in a similar position, so like, were your plans sort of to change some of the same things or pursue similar things to what Sky Hub has ended up being? Or how much influence have you had in sort of how they're implementing this, the science behind it?
Sure. So, so for those that don't know, so as part of my,
sorry to bring up painful memories.
No, you are all good. No, no reason. Oh my God. No, you're fine. So part of me putting, again, kind of my money where my mouth was and getting involved in these communities was frankly trying to engage with what at the time I thought was the, you know, the most viable sort of UFO community out there, which was MUFON.
Yeah.
And so for those that don't know, MUFON stands for the Mutual UFO Network. I had a tremendous amount, it turns out a lot of MUFON is its own hype, you know, like MUFON is sort of like, not to throw shade, but like kind of like Flavor Flav, I think, in a way, where like a lot of like Flavor Flav is like not a particularly like skilled rapper or musician, really. it seems like, but is just like the loudest person in the room that's like, yo, it's, you know, like hype man, right? Like, yeah, Mufon right. is sort of his own hype man. And so you hear these stories, or you watch these TV shows where it's like, you know, oh, the Mufon investigators went to the house and they did a thorough sweep of the area and whatever. And it right. turns out that like those Mufon investigators are like three dudes who took a $20 online course with flashlights and like Polaroid cameras. You know right. I mean? Who just ate at a Cracker Barrel. Like it's not, you know, we're not. And again, no hate at all to the actual investigators, because they're spending their own damn money and time to do this
right.
for an organization that does not care about them at all.
Yeah.
But so Mufon, it turns out, like, it's like a maybe at the absolute height of its power in the 2010s, was like 1,000 members big.
Okay.
Like there are more people in there are probably more people in the Mad Scientist Podcast fan club than there are current MUFON members.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was thinking it was much larger than that.
Yeah.
No, it is exceptionally small. They are complete. They have been in the red for years and years and years.
Wow.
The only thing MUFON really exists today to do is to create stuff to sell to the History Channel and to hold a conference every year so that they can pay the one kind of paid position they have in the organization.
Yeah.
And then there are chapters, which are varying levels of run, you know, of kind of managed,
yeah.
Depending on the state itself and the people that are there. And those people are really doing the work of what MUFON was supposed to do.
Yeah.
So okay. when I came on board, my goal was to first off try my best to build a sort of better, more robust science education core for yeah. MUFON members, you know.
Yeah, gotcha.
Like I'll never forget the first MUFON meeting I ever went to. There was a guy there who claimed that because crop circles were circular and so were orbitals in atomic structure, that aliens were talking to us in quantum mechanics.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Yeah, complete gobbledygook, right? Like, it makes no sense.
You're probably sitting there like, what have I gotten I was ready into?
To, I was ready to rip my chair apart. Like, I was so angry, and it was yeah. so stupid. And there were people there, like, nice people who had been kind to me, who were like, oh, my God, we're so excited to have you here, you know, who were just eating it up, you know? I remember, too, there was one time where there was a guy giving a talk on like reptiles or, you know, reptilians or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And some said something like, you know, the president is controlled or whatever. And then an old lady whispered to another one next to her. She was like, Obama. And I remember being like, good God, like, come on. It's like, you know, it really does. And then though, there are chapters that are like, all PhDs or former engineers yeah. or just people who are like really, really dedicated to investigating, right? Like you don't right. need a PhD to be doing science. You know, and so there are some states that are run like really, really well, other states that are run not so well. And so that was kind of the goal, was to create a basically like almost an FAQ where we could say like, hey, if you have, or not even FAQ, but like create a board where if a person investigating a case had a science question that they wanted answered, they could come to us and get answered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the first thing. One yeah. of the other things we were working on was something like a big data analytics project where we would take yeah. all of the MUFON cases that had been collected over the last, you know, 40 years and feed them through, just do like, you know, start with basic statistics and then try to get more advanced from there.
Right.
The problem with that is, you know, imagine trying to do a statistical survey where the survey is given differently every single time.
No.
Yeah. The data is entered differently by different people every mm-hmm. single time. And a lot of the questions are things like, how far away do you think the object was?
Right?
Like it's an impossibility to do any kind of good statistical analysis on that. So that were kind of the goals of what I was hoping to do. And then eventually within MUFON, I kind of grew consistently concerned about some of the, like, ufology has a right wing bend to it generally.
Right. Yeah.
And sometimes that bend becomes a problem. Like, not, it's not a bend. It's not just like, oh, the people that are like into UFOs tend to be former military, so they tend to be conservative. It's like the people into UFOs are like really excited to be going to the Capitol to like overthrow the government. You know what I mean? Like, it edges from like, it edges from like, you know, okay, fine. Haha. Yeah. You're conservative. I'm liberal. We're different, to like, this guy is like a, you know, this guy is like building pipe bombs.
So, well, and that's like what freaks me out about some of the UFO community stuff is like, yeah, there's definitely that sort of, I don't know, subsect of it that's like, you guys are a little.
There's always been that. What's interesting, if you kind of look at the history of conspiracy theories and the history of fringe kind of pseudoscience, right? It always ebbs and flows that way, where in the 60s, a lot of the UFO sort of cult-like behavior focused on, you know, like Scientology and free love communes and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And so more more of like a liberal bend. And then today it's taken on more of a conservative anti-government bend.
Right.
And I think that probably when this fever breaks, we'll be back to the other side. But part of that actually is because of ufology has sort of become very religious in its in its following. And I don't mean that as like people are into UFOs with like a religious devotion. I mean like people believe the Vatican is hiding an alien. You know what I mean? Like people believe that like aliens are angels and all that kind of stuff, right? So it's interesting how these kind of conspiracy theories intermingle with something that at the end of the day I tend to think might have something interesting really happening with it, right? Like I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think there was a chance that we'd capture a UFO on camera, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to be open to and cognizant of the crap.
Right.
So eventually, so why I ended up leaving MUFON was because it turned out that someone who had been mired in extreme controversy about very racist views was still a really big important part of a huge swath of the community on the East Coast of the United States. And so I basically said to the leadership team, like, listen, I'm gonna quit unless this person is kicked out once and for all. And they were like, well, guess we won't have science then.
Bye.
So I quit.
We don't need science.
So I quit. And then,
And
it's interesting because when I joined the group, part of the reason why I joined the group is because MUFON was already in a really bad position. They had lost a lot of members. They had lost a lot of their best people. And the way that it was kind of described to me was essentially, you know, we really need new blood. We need new ideas. And then to go in there and find out that, like, well, actually, no, the money is still in the bad old ideas. Okay, cool. Well, that's great. And then, and now, you know, just even more and more scandal continues to happen. The head of MUFON was found to be, was caught in a child sex sting.
Oh,
like,
no.
It just, it's all, it just, it's never good. It's never good. And so it's like, you just, I cannot say enough for listeners, do not join MUFON. Do not do it. The lanyard is not worth it. I promise.
Well, so I'm like glad that when we talked about it, we were sort of like, they sort of sound like they want to be scientific on their website, but like, not really.
Yeah. The challenge is that, again, like there was a person at the History Channel who actually, when he passed away recently, a lot of the people who were like in the UFO community were mourning this person's passing. And I mean, I'm sure he was a good friend, and it's always sad when someone dies, but that guy was like responsible for, you know, Ancient Aliens and all of the other crap about aliens that got its way onto the History Channel, essentially. And
yeah.
And he was sort of like the direct pipeline between, you know, MUFON to like the History Channel, you know?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. it's sort of one of those things where, although at the ultimate failure of MUFON, I think, was trying to be entertainment while talking about mm-hmm. science.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that also, I think, is a failure of a lot of UFO organizations, and it never goes well because science isn't entertaining. You know, like it's a lot of yeah. work and a lot of Excel charts and Origin Lab and right, like it's a lot of writing. It's just yeah. it's not always that interesting.
Right. Yeah, I think like if people had to watch a show where it was as much as like I would love to see somebody do it, if people had to watch a show of like an actually scientific approach to like, I don't know, looking for ghosts or like, you know, trying to find aliens or Bigfoot or whatever, they'd be like, this is the
it would not get good ratings, you know, it would be canceled immediately.
Right, like, you know, the Big Bang Theory where Sheldon just hits run on his Linux machine as it compiles to see what two atoms do when they get near each other. That's a lot less interesting. And the Big Bang yeah. Theory is just hot garbage, but
we agree on that.
Sorry. Thank God you said that. Right. We're going to have to end the interview right now.
No, terrible, terrible show, which is the worst. But yeah, you know, it's not always entertaining. And so it becomes this yeah. interplay between, you know, well, how do you get good, like, you know, with Sky Hub, like we've done a lot of interviews about Sky Hub now. And yeah. I think that interviewers, especially if they're more of the UFO kind of bend or haven't done science themselves before, are like, well, what are you guys working on mm-hmm. right now? Like, what's the craziest piece of data you've gotten? And I'm like, you know, well, we still haven't calibrated yeah. anything. So like, we don't have any data. And they're like, we're not going to, we're not going to book you again. You know, like they want me to come on and say like, you know, we got a telepathic message from Zardon, you know, like that's not how it works.
Yeah. What's the Betty and Barney Zeta Reticuli or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, the Zeta Reticuli.
What theirs is. There are a couple videos though posted on the Sky Hub website though, right? Of that are denoted as like UAPs or something like that.
Yeah. Currently, I guess the way that we're trying to do the Sky Hub development is we're trying to do things in a phased mm-hmm. approach, right? Like any good kind of project management style tries. So
yeah.
the first phase was getting all of the components to talk to each other and work together. That has been successful. The second phase mm-hmm. was getting automatic object detection, recording, and upload to occur. That has been successful.
Yeah.
That is what – those are the videos that are you're seeing on the website. So there are currently about a dozen Sky Hub units out there in the world. They all are constantly viewing the sky, and they are – when an object appears in view – they are recording that encounter and then uploading it into the cloud.
Okay.
The next step is the sort of data analytics step, which is taking that video, converting the data within the video into, you know, metrics by which we can do a statistical analysis of what an airplane looks like, a bird looks like, etc.
Yeah.
And then the actual siloing. So
okay.
the first three stages are complete. And those are kind of the, I guess, the first two stages, I think, is how I, whatever. The first sections of project work are complete. You know, the good news about an open source project like this is we're able to pull from a lot of the really great work other people have already done with things like, you know, optical flow mm-hmm. and object detection and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
a lot of that technology already kind of exists out there. A lot of that code is out there. It's just a matter of us making it work for our purposes. So that's really the stage that we're at now is that.
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of, I guess, if you think about our deliverables or what we think, mm-hmm. we've hit already what we consider to be the minimum viable product from Sky Hub, which is something that'll take automatic upload of video of objects in the sky above your home.
Yeah. Right?
That has already been completed. Now, the next step is getting a more robust machine learning model implemented, adding other sensor data and trying other applications. So that's really where we're at now.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so cool. Like, just importantly, we bring up things like MUFON and To the Stars and Allista and Bigelow and everything, because like, I see SkyHub as so different, and like, it's just so fun to hear somebody talk about like, like actually scientifically valid ways of approaching right. all of this.
Has anyone else really taken this approach? Because it doesn't seem like it. I mean, everyone kind of claims to.
So this project, so if you look at kind of the literature on what this field that we're kind of playing in is called, it goes by a couple of different names, but the one I've seen, I guess, the most often now in the literature is space surveillance, or, you know, near Earth object detection and tracking. So in the 60s and 70s, the United States developed what were known as Baker-Nunn cameras. And these were kind of like really early SkyHub units where, but they were only, what they essentially did was they would take images of the sky at a set shutter speed, and they had a telescope on there as well. And so at night they would take shots of the sky with a, you know, short shutter speed, but a long, oh my goodness, what's the word now? Exposure, right?
Yeah.
And then based on the trail of objects moving, they would estimate speed, distance, etc., and basically create a map of the sky of all of the satellites in Earth's orbit. The goal being that if NASA wanted to launch a satellite or a rocket or whatever, they didn't want it to collide with anything, and we had no way of knowing what was out there.
Right.
The government then sort of stopped caring about that because we like stopped going to space. And frankly, too, GPS location and sort of radio technology got so robust and good that it no longer became, it no longer was required to track objects in the sky with a camera, right? Because you could just know where something was based on the signal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Recently, though, like last 10 years, it has become a bigger thing of interest. And actually, the United States Space Force just, one of their big first projects is going to be essentially trying to do something like a SkyHub, but for defense purposes, right? Because you can imagine.
You guys should just get that sweet, sweet defense contract money.
I know, right? I wish. If you can imagine, you know, you can buy a drone from Walmart for like, you know, $100. You throw a camera on that thing and you fly it over a military base. Like, you could find out mad stuff you're not supposed to know. You know what I mean? Probably.
Right.
It is definitely something of kind of national security concern, I think, that they're considering or really thinking about seriously. So,
right.
In terms of, so that's kind of like the kind of professional world, I guess, is what I'll say. From the UFO world, or kind of the world of the weird, there have been other attempts to do stuff like this. But again, the original Baker-Nunn cameras, they cost something like $2 million a camera.
Oh,
yeah. Crazy, right? Like my SkyHub production unit cost me like $500, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's my thing can do way more than the Baker-Nunn cameras could do. So the difference between sort of the technology and the size and the capabilities of these things has really changed pretty consistently and gotten to the point now where you can build one yourself at home. So a lot of those other efforts kind of had some of the same problems where, you know, units were really expensive or they were really clunky or they're just like one of the big problems with this is scale. You know, one camera can't monitor the whole sky. So if we really want to do something interesting, you know, you can imagine like you get 20 of these units, you place them all in a given area for pretty high geographic coverage and do like an actual study, right, of the sky. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have been possible with those other efforts because the units were just too big. They're too big and too expensive.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I was just going to make a silly comment before Paige asked her question, was that, Chris, have you seen, I don't know if you've seen the HBO show Silicon Valley.
I absolutely have, and I love that show.
Okay, great. Well, I was like, the thing of like the phase that you're in now, which is like trying to, you know, teach the machine learning program to identify things like airplanes and all these other different things that might be passing through the field of view, and then allowing it to, you know, automatically do that. Uh-huh. I thought of the
hot dog, no hot dog.
Yes, hot dog. No.
It's honestly
where they get all excited because they think he's gonna create the they think he's gonna create the program to automatically identify foods that people eat, and then they're all excited because it identifies it's a hot dog, and then they like, no show it off, and it's like just not hot.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. I love,
yeah,
I absolutely love that show. Actually, my wife and I, we will joke with each other. There's a scene where Jimmy O Yang, who plays, oh my God, what's his name?
Jin Yang, right?
Yeah. Jin Yang. Where he calls Eric and he's like, you know, he's like, hello, Eric. This is you as an old man. You suck. Right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
I'll call my wife and be like, hello, Kitty. This is you as an old lady.
You know? You suck.
So good. You suck.
Like Stephen always says, that's like the real representation of like nerd culture, not Big Bang Theory.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So anyway, I was thinking like, is everything going to start out as like airplane?
No airplane. Airplane?
We're just going to be able to show that stuff isn't a hot dog flying in the sky. Honestly.
There should be some sort of like little Easter egg in the code or something.
I'll have to talk to the team.
Tell people it's not like, hot dog.
You know what's so funny is like, I am not like programming savvy at all. Like the only type of programming I really know is like some really basic C and some Fortran from chemical engineering, right? Like oftentimes I just kind of go in there and I'm like, hey guys, I think this would be cool. And they're like, oh, God damn it, that would be cool. It's going to take so long to do that. Like, you know how hard that is. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's interesting though. But anyone who's listening who is a programmer, please do check out our Git repo and help us out if you like.
Yeah, if I had any skills in that area, I would offer them to you, but I'm
I was going to say, I have
useless,
literally
I
no skills other than like very basic Python skills.
Right, that's all I've got.
Years and years ago. So.
From my physics one class in my sophomore year
that's
in college.
That's literally where mine are from. Oh, no. Yeah, no, I have nothing. Okay, so I think that brings us sort of to the end, right, Paige?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, big question here is how can people get involved? I know there's a lot of information on your website, and we've got a couple articles that have some information, but can you give kind of a brief, I don't know, update or whatever on how people can get involved and kind of get this going at their place if they want?
Which obviously you just said you guys need, you know, programmers potentially, but
yeah. So if people go over to our website at skyhub.org, you can find on the top tab there's an option that says contact us. And then there's actually a chat link. We have an ongoing chat on Rocket Chat all the time. That's with the whole team and people who are part of our community. It's gotten to be like pretty huge now, but if you want to get involved and talk with us, that's probably the easiest way.
Awesome.
Another thing you can do, of course, is if you want to build one of these units. So like we said, this is all open source and we're not selling like component parts. We're actually in the process of manufacturing a kind of case for all the stuff. So at least it is in one thing for you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, essentially you need a Jetson Nano. You need a camera that can connect to a Jetson Nano. We have some recommendations for those. And you need like a GPS dongle. And that's what you need really to get started on this. Mm-hmm. As we add more sensors, as we add more pieces to the unit, you know, the kind of list of stuff you can get will change. But the goal here is to build something that's really plug and play, that if you, again, are interested in birds, you can add on stuff that'll be useful for bird watching instead of it just being for airplanes and stuff like that.
So cool.
Yeah, super cool. Yeah. And I think that's good to know about the chat because I know I had started to make my husband, Steve, look at, you know, some of the components that were required and everything to build it. And he definitely had some, like, you guys had certain specific computer components that were recommended or required or something that he was thinking, like, do I, like, because we have a ton of these things sitting around. So it's like, he was like, well, could I, like, source in another one, or is there, like, yeah, so anyway, yeah. So we have some specific questions that we'll toss you in that,
yeah,
that chat.
Jump in the chat for sure. Yeah, we are we're always kind of answering people's questions and stuff and helping them build them. It's really, like, you know, like we said, it's, we're really trying to make this as accessible to people as possible. If I could build one,
yeah,
I mean, I'm sure you guys will be able to build them. If I was able to build it, anyone can build one. I you know,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not super hard.
Okay, I think that's pretty much it. Paige, do you want to do wrap-up stuff?
Yeah, sure. Before we do, though, because I know you kind of already did this, but is there any kind of last-second plugs for your podcast or any other work you're doing right now that you'd like to get in here before we wrap up?
Yeah, where can people find you, all that?
Sure, yeah. So you can find us on Twitter at Mad Scientist Pod, on Spotify, Spreaker, Google Podcasts, all your favorite podcast apps. Our show is called The Mad Scientist Podcast, and this season we'll be focusing on times when science has been wrong, which is really exciting.
Whoa.
So yeah, it's going to be great. So come check us out.
So we will be sure to post links to SkyHub and The Mad Scientist Podcast on our website and in the show notes, so that way it's easy for people to find you.
All right. Thank you so much. Super exciting. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This has been great.
Yeah, anytime you guys want to have us on, please let us know.
All right, we definitely will. All right, spooky people. Well, that wraps up this week's episode. One last huge thank you to Chris for joining us this week. This was a lot of fun. Tune in next time for our discussion on the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. If you like our show, please hit subscribe and share with a friend. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Spooky SciPod, Facebook at Spooky Science Sisters, and at our website, SpookyScienceSisters.com. If you have any questions about previous topics, ideas for future episodes, or any spooky stories you'd like us to share, you can email us at SpookyScienceSisters@gmail.com. Thanks for your listening, and stay spooky.
This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.